Welcome to this meeting of the Ways and Means Committee, and I call us to order and note for the record that a quorum is present.
And it probably.
And so our agenda for today is we are going to do House File 1234, House File 782, so the two pension bills first. Then we'll do House Senate File 2744, Stevenson Commerce, and then we'll end with House File 2, Ruth Richardson, Paid Family and Medical Leave. And being this is sort of our last official Ways meeting, we'll likely have another one sometime to do the claims bill, workers' comp, and some other more less time-sensitive bills that aren't quite our budget bills. So this is our last day of passing budget bills out of committee. And so with that, Representative Becker Finn from Aqua Coffee brought coffee. There's treats passed around. So make sure you get up and grab what you need to sustain yourselves for the last of our big hearings as we then head to the floor later today. So with that, I will call Representative Herr up for House File 1234. And I will move that House File 1234 be placed on the general register. So welcome to the committee, Representative Herr. And I will also move the 8A amendment to your bill. And could you, once you're settled and ready, would you mind just briefly talking about the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee. The 8A amendment is just a combination of the amendments that we accepted in pensions when it was heard there, and then some technical language that we proposed to stakeholders late of last week to just work through some of the administrative costs and how that will be handled for this particular situation. And so that's actually the summary of what is in the 8A.
Any discussion to the 8A amendment? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Herr, we've gotten an awful lot of emails of very, very concerned people that are law enforcement or others that are on disability and such. Has this amendment, does it resolve their concerns?
Representative Herr.
Madam Chair and Representative Olson, O'Neill, thank you for the question. So there are many questions about this bill and a lot of things that are left unresolved. This does not solve all of the concerns still that each of the stakeholders have brought forward. I have met with the group that is concerned with this particular issue. I've had multiple communication with them. This coming to the agreement where we are right now took 3 years to do, and I work with 15 stakeholder groups. And so all of the changes that have been made go in front of the entire stakeholder group, and that at this point, because there's been so much work put into it, any changes to the bill that is substantial, which that change would be, would actually undermine the entire bill and not be able to get the other stakeholders on board for us to get this across the finish line. And so I have made a commitment to this group, along with many other groups, and the issues that they want, in that we put it on the parking lot for continued work on this bill, because this bill is not done. This is what we need to do right now to address the issue that we need to around financial stability of the plan, around the health of the plan, around active officers and what they're paying, around getting ensuring that people have the health care that they need in order to do the job that they love, that this is what we have to do right now, and that there are many items that we are still working on the parking lot list. Again, as I stated, there are 15 stakeholders at the table. Nobody walked away with everything that they wanted. This is the best that we can do with the agreement that we have.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's all I have for the amendment. I just wanted to know how much it resolved the outstanding issues, and then I'll have some other questions for the underlying bill.
That sounds good. And we'll discussion to the AA amendment, because Representative Herr hasn't had a chance to present the bill. So if it's more broad, maybe we'll wait just to get the bill in the shape. So questions to the AA amendment. Any further discussion to the AA amendment? 8A, that's a weird way of doing it. 8A amendment. Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So now to your bill as amended, Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Olson. And this bill, as amended, provides the much-needed opportunity for employees with psychological conditions to get the treatment that they need. The employee's treatment, salary, and other benefits are paid for by the employer. This bill does not change PARA's current administrative process for reapplication, nor does it require requirements or eligibility for the reapplication process. And this really is something that just we are addressing an issue that has come up within this plan. Chair Olson, I just want to draw the committee's attention to the fact that not only does this bill work to ensure that our peace officers and firefighters who work really hard ensure community safety, that they get the treatment that they need, which did not happen in the prior years. And so, again, as I stated, this bill has been worked on for almost 3 years and has been through now, I think, 18 revisions. and has the support. And there were 15 stakeholders at the table. And as you all noticed in your support letter packet, there are letters in there from MPPOA. There's a joint city letter of support from League of Minnesota Cities, Metro Cities, Municipal Legislative Commission, Minnesota Association of Small Smith Cities, Minnesota Fire Association Coalition, Minnesota Chiefs of Police, Joint Chief Letters of Support from the Association of Minnesota Counties, Minnesota Intercounty Association, Minnesota Professional Firefighters, and PARA. And so there has been a lot of work with a lot of support from a lot of individuals in here. Again, as I stated, this bill really addresses the fact that we do have an issue with the ongoing health of the pension plans, and that and there are many things that we are also trying to address in this, which is also parity within the plans of officers and to ensure that the for those who are on disability and those who are still active. And so there's a lot that we're trying to do with this bill. And, you know, I will take any questions regarding this bill at this time.
Thank you, Representative Furr. And I will note, as we know, that in this committee we don't typically take testimony. And so we did have a fair number of letters coming in the packet. Mm-hmm. So just want to note for the record that those are in the packet. And that'll be the same, that'll be true for the rest of the bills. Obviously, we won't be doing public testimony, but we do have everything in the packet that had came into the committee administrator. So discussion to the bill. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Herr, you talked about ongoing costs. You talked about the bill unraveling, if anything is done to do that. And we have to recover some money to save the PERA police and fire plan. Changing the caps from 125% to 100% retroactively, how much difference will that make in the plan? How much money will be recovered, or however you want to describe it, additional resources for the police and fire fund, if your changes go from 125 to 100%?
Chair Olson, Representative Novotny. So I just want to be very clear. It has never been positioned that the cap on the offsets was to recover costs for the plan, that it is actually that piece of it was created in order to create to ensure parity. So for just an understanding of that, to just note what you stated, that someone now can't make more than 125% of their salary. So an actual police duty disability officer can't make more than an officer who is actually active. And so and I just want to keep this in perspective for us, that of the 20 some thousand individuals on duty disability, about 300 people are impacted by this. And of these 300, the impact is actually when we looked at the ones that did come through PARA and did call, that the impact was either small or minimal. And I want to just state that that doesn't mean that there aren't people who are impacted by this. There are. But again, we want to ensure that this is not to recover costs in order to help the plan. This is going to cost now the fiscal note, and as you all have in your packets, it's about $28 million. That's the cost that we are working on and to try to save. So this piece of this this reapplication process, and I want to be very clear, it is not retroactive. The process doesn't change. If you are on duty disability and you, how it works right now is for the first 5 years, every year, you reapply. That's happening right now already. That's not retroactive. And then going forward, every 3 years. And so they're reassessing that every 3 years. So I just want to be very clear that when we're talking about this, that we're talking about what is actually happening, not what people are telling us is happening within for this particular bill.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Herr, I'll rephrase the question. How much money will PERA get in additional funds from these individuals if they maintain their current earning schedules, because they have to submit what they make every year to PERA? How much additional funds will the PERA Police and Fire Fund get from these individuals that you describe, approximately 300 individuals, if you change their cap from 125 to 100?
Representative
Hurt. Chair Olson, Representative Botany. The plan doesn't get any money for doing this. It just doesn't cost the plan more now. And so, yes, the savings is about $2 million. But I just want to be very clear. Again, this is not to make the plan more healthy. What we're doing and ensuring that the officers who get the help that they need and how we've set up this, is that is the part that is going to change this, ensure that the plan is healthy. So to be very clear, again, the plan doesn't make money from this. It's not getting money. It's just not now going to have these additional expenses because someone's my apologies, that offsets ensure that then there's not an additional $2 million and that people are kept. And just to be clear again on this is that it also mirrors MSRS's plan, and it's 100% re-earnings. And so the plan is still one of the most it is actually still the most generous duty disability plan in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Herr,
mm-hmm.
And this has been part of my frustration ever since this bill came down, trying to get a straight answer out of anyone. It took the better part of 3 weeks and phone calls to get a number from PERA. I just wanted a number. You came into public safety and you were claiming, you threw out the number of $40 million that they have to make up, and that the active members, if that $40 million isn't made up, would increase the active members' contribution by 1.3%.
Mm-hmm.
And I will fully admit that I barely graduated from 11th grade math class. I took the minimum, but even I could run the numbers and say that that $40 million didn't make sense when you're talking about 300 members. Even if we took every member that is out right now on duty disability, there is no way it could add up to $40 million. So after several phone calls and a bunch of digging, I finally got an answer last week from PERA. They assume if nothing changes, they will get $2 million. And I can forward you that email. They will get $2 million if nothing changes. You have individuals that are out on duty disability right now that are looking at losing a third of their income based on which offset and what they made when they left and what they're making now, and every individual's got a different number. Long and short of it is, if nothing changes and all these members that are out, and assuming that they don't say, forget about it, I'm just gonna sit home and look out the window, or I'll take a job where I'm a volunteer or something. If nothing changes and you don't get the people opting out of the system, $2 million out of a $40 million deficit, and I could be wrong, we're looking at 5%. That's a 5% out of $40 million. $2 million that you say will screw up the whole bill. This whole bill will crash over that. You've seen the emails. I've seen the emails. Some of these people I personally know and can verify their stories. And it is causing them stress. There's a funeral today in Zumbrota. If you don't think it's causing these people to go into serious problems, wondering how they're going to handle their financial situations because of $2 million and we've got a $19 billion surplus, you're wrong. These people, for whatever the reasons, and keep in mind, this isn't PTSD restricted. It's anyone that is out on PTSD is subjected to these caps. Whatever their circumstances were, they walked out the door, they were handed a piece of paper across the table, and they said, this is your new reality, you got to deal with this. They've made decisions based on, will they work, will their spouse work, will they go back to school, do they buy a smaller house, do they make any of the decisions that they make because of that table that was slid across, that piece of paper that was slid across the table to them at the time that it happened. And now 2, 4, 5, 10 years later, depending on how old they are, you're coming in and saying, we're going to make a decision that could cost you $10,000-$12,000 a year. If that's all it takes to upset this whole bill, when we're talking PERA lost over $1 billion in their investments, our funding level for PERA hasn't changed. It's been at 92% for years and years, and all of a sudden the house of cards will fall over $2 million. I just don't buy it. Representative Hearn, thank you.
Representative Hearn.
Chair Olson and Representative Votney, thank you for your comments. I do want to be very clear that no one has stated that over $2 million, that the entire plan would just fall apart. I want to be very honest with you that it's not that you haven't gotten a straight answer. This is actually a very complex situation, and I wish you would have come to me. We could have had the discussion. I'm speaking right now, Representative Novotny, and so I just want to be very clear that it can be all of those things and everything, that it does cost. Initially, our estimate, because it took us 6 weeks to, when we started working on this fiscal note, it took us 6 weeks to get it. At that point, we actually were estimating about $50 million the cost. That's not a cost that we made out of thin air. We actually, the fiscal note will show you why it is, now they're telling us it's $28 million, which is great because it costs less than we thought, and that gives us some room to work with this. But I didn't get this fiscal note until literally before this Ways and Means meeting. And so we heard the people who came to us and said this is an issue for them. We've already actually changed that offset twice. And so we actually made it more favorable each time. We've continued to do that, and we will continue to be committed to doing that. I want to be very clear that all of the things that you stated around the cost of the when we initiate that $40 million, the cost of this $2 million, all of these pieces can all be true. One thing doesn't fix this problem, which is why it is a complex problem, and we're looking at many pieces in order to address this. And so I'm sorry that I didn't make everybody happy in this bill. Nobody was. If you talk to any of the 15 stakeholders, they are fighting for things that they still have not gotten for our active police officers, for those cities who are saying, we are going bankrupt because we had one officer go out on duty disability, and we had to raise our levy 12%. That was Niswa that testified to that. No one is happy with this. And the fact that I don't have ongoing funding for this, and that this is actually one-time money, and I still have to figure out how to fund this ongoing. Otherwise, it falls back onto small cities and onto individual departments. I still don't have the solutions for either. So you're right. There are a lot of things that are going on with this plan. I don't have the answers for, and I would love to, but this is the condition that I am working within to try to solve this problem. And again, to be very clear, we never said that this offset solves the problem of the cost in this plan. And I also want to be very clear, PARA did not just lose $1 billion. This is an issue that has been building over the last few years. The market has actually done really well. Our plans actually, SBI does a great job in our investments. This is not an investments issue. This is not a plan issue. And also, our pension plans have fiduciary responsibilities. They don't just answer to the laws that Minnesota sets, but they also have their own plan agreements as to how equity looks like within their plans, and they also have to comply with federal laws. We are making these plans so that it is equitable between all of the different plans, and I just want to again reemphasize that MPPOA supports this bill because we understand that there is not a solution that will help everyone, and I'm sorry that you're frustrated. I am too. If you saw me these last few weeks about trying to get the rest of these changes through, I've been extremely frustrated as well. And so I hope that we continue to work together in order to find a solution. And I have been very clear that I will continue to look at the offset. PARA has already made some recommendations to me as potentially other additional things that we can do. We will continue to work on this bill.
Representative O'Neill. Representative Novotny.
If I could just respond, and I will be brief.
Representative
Novotny. Representative Herr, I brought this concern to you over a month ago, and I agree. House 1234 has many things that are good. It's not a single issue bill. It's like a mini omnibus bill, and there are many things in it that are good. I agree. And there are many things that these stakeholder groups are buying into. And I just think it's cruel to pull back and change these. It's stud poker. You get dealt the hand you were dealt, and you can't draw other cards. And it is cruel. Madam Chair, I move that we table this bill.
A motion to table the bill. That's a non-debatable motion. So all those in favor of tabling the bill, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no.
No. No.
The motion does not prevail, and the bill is not tabled. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Herr. I know that in the early versions of this last session, you and I worked on this together, and it has really grown, and it is very much like what Representative Botany said. It's almost an omnibus bill for this issue area. It's gone so much further than the initial bill. I just have one question, though, because there is so much passion, and, you know, he's law enforcement and retired, and so he has his finger on the pulse of what's happening with those 300 officers and those that are on the plan. I'm wondering, is it possible, if it is a $2 million difference, is it possible to just hold them harmless? And can you do an amendment on the floor to just, you know, retroactively hold them harmless for the people that are retroactive, those 300 that you mentioned? Is that possible?
Representative Furr.
Chair Olson, Representative Neal, thank you for that suggestion. The truth is it's not my decision to make. I would have to put that in front of the 15 stakeholders and say, because for them, this offset was important. For the plan, the offset was important, and there are very specific reasons why they were. So it's not something that I could just make an amendment for. I would have to then, again, call a stakeholder meeting and get everyone's buy-in and having to understand what they're compromising in order to take this. So, I mean, I'm always open to suggestions, but again, just as, and I'm going to use an example that might be a little bit, seems like it's off base, but it really isn't, is that when we're looking at the health of pension plans, right, we're trying to guarantee people pensions into the future. So just as I'm not happy with this, I wish I had $3 billion to do this, but like teachers at one point, they said, we have tier one teachers, and starting this date, these other teachers have different benefits, right? And like, there is just a cutoff at some point, and it feels really cruel. I get it. I have officers who are who in my family. I have officers who are on PTSD. I know this is not something like that I don't know people personally. I do. And so I would have to put this in front of them, but at this point, I cannot make any promises because there's not, like I've stated in other committees, there is not one provision in this bill that actually belongs to me. I didn't make one suggestion in this bill. Everything in this bill came from the stakeholders. And so if it were just up to me, sure, maybe I could just make an amendment, but I can't at this point. And I just want to be very honest and frank about that. And I just wanted to also add, I know this wasn't your question, but I want to add to just to Representative Novotny's point that we took this so seriously that if an officer is on permanent disability, we actually increase their benefit to almost 100%. Because we understand that when you get hurt in the line of duty and you are permanently disabled, you should have 100% of your pay. And so we actually did some things that are really good for officers in this bill. And so I just want to make sure that we don't lose sight of that those officers who were shot very recently, who are permanently disabled, they will have almost 100% of their benefits and their pensions. And so I just don't want that to be lost within this conversation.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last thing I'll ask is, in your negotiations, the part that Representative Novotny is so concerned about, the 300 that you would retroactively change their benefits, was that brought up? And is that something, I mean, is that just an absolute no from certain stakeholders that they couldn't manage that? And I hear what you said about the city of Nisswa. Or is this still a possibility? Because we've all gotten the emails, right? We've all gotten the flood of emails regarding how this would affect people. So I'm just wondering if, and the other, so I have two questions. Have you discussed it? And it is something that you would be willing to discuss with the stakeholders between now and when it's calendared for the floor.
Representative Furr.
Chair Olson and Representative O'Neill, this has been discussed, and there were discussions years before I even got here. So Majority Leader Long actually was the chief author of this bill for 2 years. I've only taken it on this year. I know that labor was at the table, and so people representing our officers, and they fought vigorously for every aspect of what would be right for our officers. And so it's not that this issue hasn't been discussed. It hasn't been touched on. Like I said, everybody made compromises. I can't go back to the table and say, we're going to give one group now everything that they need and want, which I would love to do, and then say to everybody else, but none of you get everything that you want. And so this, and then you all are lawmakers, you know, we compromise. This is what we have to do. But like I said, I can't make changes now because this is the agreement that everyone made. And I will be more than willing to have a discussion because one of the conditions of working with this group in our last meeting was I said to them, you all have to be committed to coming back next year with me to look, did this bill do what we wanted it to do? And then what are the changes that we need to make? And this is one of those items that is on my list in order for us to reassess and say, did it do what we wanted it to do? And so I'm committed to ongoing work with this, but I cannot at this point, with the agreement that's been made and how it's moving in the Senate, I can't make changes here without agreement also of my Senate counterpart and also all of the stakeholders. So I wish that I wasn't honest about my answer and I could just say, yeah, sure, I'll do it, and then not do it. I just can't, you know, and that's my honest answer.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. That's why we've worked together so many times. You're not just going to say something to placate me because, you know, we have that relationship and we'll have that conversation. Okay, so the bill is as it is. It's not going to change. It's going to be to the floor exactly as it is, which is, as Representative Navani pointed out, incredibly problematic for at least 300 officers, if not more, and other people in the plan. My concern is, you talked about maybe working on this after this bill passes. My concern is the you're already retroactively changing someone's benefits. No? Does it go into effect later? Okay. So maybe you could just tell us when it goes into effect, and maybe there is a little bit of a window.
Representative Hurd.
Chair Olson, Representative Neal, I know that the word retroactively keeps being used, but we're not going back and clawing back any benefits that somebody has already had. This is ongoing into the regular process of reapplication. And so even if this goes into effect, if somebody is already in their 3 years, so let's say I'm in the first year of my 3 years in due to disability, my particular benefit isn't going to be looked at until its next reapplication, which is 3 years from now. And so not everybody is going to see a change in their benefits immediately because this bill moves forward. So that's, I don't know if that answers your question, but yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll talk about it more on the floor, but I just wanted to have a fuller understanding of this, as we all have just gotten a flood of emails about it. It's a very hot issue. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to you, Chair Herr, I just want to say thank you for the bill, and I just want to kind of level set. Last year, or last session, you know, I did not support this legislation, and I did my very best to make sure that it didn't pass because I didn't think it was ready for prime time. There were members of our large active duty unions who did not support the legislation. And I just want to say thank you for taking the time to do this really rough work. You know, we have roughly 12,000 active members. And when we put our officers and fire in harm's way, we always have to make sure that we stand by them when they are injured in that line of duty, wherever they serve. The legislation last year put me at odds with my own city leadership. And so I wanted to make sure that we were doing right by those we're putting in harm's way, but also making sure that we were doing right by the taxpayers of our state. And while I do not believe, as you have stated, that this is everything everybody wants, it is a compromise. And that's what the people of Minnesota are asking us to do. Find ways where we serve the most Minnesotans we can every day, but at the same time, always looking out for those that are disadvantaged. And so I just want to say thank you. I know there is a lot of misinformation about this legislation out there, which is driving fear among people who have been harmed, and I would like for that misinformation to stop. But at the same time, I just want to say thank you for the hard work that you've done. And while I know it's still a work in progress, I do appreciate the fact that you've always kept our first responders front and center in this conversation. So thank you very much, and I will be supporting the bill today. Thank you.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to represent her, I just wanted to remind you that absolutely you do have the authority to say yes to an amendment. Absolutely you do, because guess what? You're the legislator. And this is something that I've heard a few times in which people say, well, this organization, that organization. The reality is that only we can put forth legislation. They can't. They can go through legislators, et cetera. Now, it sounds like you've made your commitment that you will hold on to the decision of the group. And I think that's something that is very dangerous for us as a legislature to do when we allow outside agencies to have veto power over the bills that we decide is something that's important to do. I believe it is absolutely important for us to have stakeholder involvement and to get their input the best that they can, but it is up to us, the responsible party that are going to be making the decisions, to use that to the best of our ability to accommodate as much as we can. But the bottom line is we still have to put together a bill that is the best for the future and for moving forward. And if there needs to be continued work, we continue to work on it. But we don't allow an outside people, outside organizations, outside individuals to hold veto power over the bills that we are putting forth here. That is our responsibility. That's why we're elected. And we're not going to be able to solve everything nor make everybody happy. We'd have to do just the best that we can. So I would say I understand the predicament you're in, but I think in the future we need to be very careful that when we talk to the groups that we're negotiating with, that we understand we're taking that to the floor, but there may need to be changes into it. We can't hold fast to it because there are 134 people in this body, and that means that there are going to have a lot of people that are going to be pulling and tugging, and there's no way we should say that we're going to be able to commit 100% one way or the other. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm always struck when Representative Novotny gets clearly agitated because it's a pretty rare occurrence. I've sat next to him or in front of him or beside him in committee, and he never does that, ever. But on this issue, I think that it's rightly articulated because according to what he just said a few minutes ago, he asked for a meeting with you, Chair Herr, quite some time ago.
He didn't.
That didn't happen.
He didn't.
Well, I have the floor to quote you from earlier. I believe Representative Novotny, and what I'm getting from this conversation is that there are 300 plus or minus folks who are effectively watching or experiencing the rug being pulled out from underneath them. And Representative Petersburg is spot on. We've all carried legislation. So if you've been here for a while, I've been in the majority and minority. If you are the author of the bill, you have the last word before it goes to the floor. You're the author. You can decide what gets amended in. You can decide what gets amended out. I've watched all of you who have carried bills do just that. You have. You don't need to wait for permission from outside organizations. You have to manage that relationship. You have to manage that expectation. It's you as the author that has the last word, whether you like it or not, whether you want to own up to that or not. So the retroactivity of this is concerning. And Chair Herr just said that she got the fiscal note right before this hearing, but the date completed is 4/21 at 8:10 p.m. So today is the 24th. So we'll just let that linger there for a minute. You've had the fiscal note for a while. Now, I will say the disturbing part, and I supported Representative Novotny's motion to table the bill, that even at that time, it's not enough because it's not exactly light reading. But the message that's being sent to the 300 is, you know, buckle up, we're going to change your paradigm for you, and you should be grateful that we've done that to you. This is ridiculous. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Youakim.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to thank Representative Herr for all your work on this. I know who you are, and I know how much you talk to everybody that asked you to meet with them, and I don't think there would have been anybody else in the legislature that could have shepherded this through by working with the outside groups and the stakeholders. And I know that's important to you. I know that's important to a lot of us. So saying that we have the last word is a little bit arrogant because we have to work for the state of Minnesota and the citizens.
Madam Chair, are we doing personalities today? Are we doing personalities today?
Representative Nash, pause. She was saying, I don't think she was saying that anybody here, and I think she was saying the idea of
including me.
That. I didn't hear her call anybody into question, but that said, Representative Youakim, I will just remind everybody here that personality should not be brought in or motives. Representative Youakim.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for giving me a hip check, too, because sometimes we all deserve it. But no, I would have a hard time just making a decision right at the very end if not, I hadn't talked to all the stakeholders in the education realm as well. So I was just trying to say thank you. And thank you for all the work you do. And I know you truly mean it when you say it's still a work in progress as we're moving forward and that your door is always open. This is a tough topic This is really hard, and we want to make sure all our first responders are getting the help that they need and the pay that they deserve. So thank you.
And further discussion, I have last on my list, Lead Garofalo, before we go to final words on the bill. So Lead Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Herr. I do want to bring personalities into the debate because I think you're a serious legislator. You're someone who legislates the right way, pays attention, reads bills, and that's something that's in increasing short supply in the legislature. So I want to thank you for the work, not only how you conduct yourself on bills, but the research you do. I had the opportunity to communicate with you privately when you were spending time here on a weekend. Even though there's substance of this bill that I disagree with, I do want to bring personalities into the debate and say that you are one of the people that I wish more members of your caucus acted like you do when it came to studying bills. Madam Chair and Representative Herr, the frustration you're hearing today, and I think it's a frustration that you may share yourself, we are not, the government of the state of Minnesota is not dealing with an issue of scarcity right now. Okay? We have an unprecedented budget surplus. There is enormous resources in the hands of government. And throughout this session, we have seen legislative majorities. We've seen a trifecta disperse those funds aggressively in an unprecedented fashion with not just single digit, but huge double digit increases in appropriations and items, many of which are highly questionable. And it's very difficult for members on this side of the aisle and for those watching at home, at a time when government is flush, that it's literally drowning in money, to believe that for these individuals who have made sacrifices protecting us, that we have to take something away from them. Frustration really is an understatement for the individuals who have made these sacrifices. And, you know, I could go through and list the things that the state of Minnesota is going to be spending money on now. The sheer volume of appropriations, approaching 40% increases in spending, and we are taking this away for men and women who made the choice to sacrifice, but were dealt a bad hand in that service to us. It's very difficult to imagine, to expect and understand why this is justified. So whether it's you, whether it's a single senator in the Senate, whether it's stakeholders, I hope somebody's taking a look at this and recognizing this is unnecessary pain that is being administered on people who only mistake is they've stepped up and served us. So, thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further discussion, we'll go to Representative Herr for a final brief close on your bill.
Thank you, Chair Olson, and thank you, committee members, everyone, for your voices and your contribution. As you can all hear, too, I am also very frustrated because there are many things in this bill I do not like myself. There are things that I do not think is fair myself, and I'm not going to air those things out here because this is a good bill for what it is we are trying to do. And I just want to address a couple of really quick things is that, one, motives were impugned based Representative Nash said to me that I was telling people to buckle up and just accept this, and I actually have never said that. That's assuming that that's what I'm saying to these people, and I'm not. I'm very clear that there were people that will be impacted by this, and it's not all full 300 people, that we've actually had a lot of people which we've asked to call para and talk with them directly because everybody's situation is different. And so the only way to get an accurate understanding of your own personal situation is to actually talk with the pension plan, who may the commitment to me, who even created part of their website that says this can be in a week. If you plug in this information, it'll make these are the assumptions, then it'll actually give you an idea of what your benefit change might be. They did that because I asked them to. They put together a fact sheet that talks about what the reapplication looks like, the re-earnings look like. They did that so that people could see. I asked them to do this because I didn't want misinformation out there. I've worked really hard to not say to people, buckle up. This is what you're going to have to deal with. I've worked my ass off to not have that be the case. And so I also want to just point out that Representative Petersburg, you and I have never worked on a bill together. And what you will learn is I will never just say to somebody, this is my decision and I've decided this is what I'm going to do. I think that that is a really poor way for myself. Everybody else can operate the way you want to. I don't operate that way. And that, to be very clear, the group advocating for this change for officers and duties is also an outside agency. So if you're telling me not to listen to outside agency, to listen to one outside agency, you're actually asking me to do the thing you're telling me not to do. And so I just want to be very clear that this is also an outside agency. And if I have to respect the other 15 stakeholder groups, I have to respect this group, then I have to do all of them. I can't do just one. And so I just want to make sure that I point that out, in that this is an outside influence as well. And you're asking me to accommodate them and not everybody else. And then I also just want to be really clear that Representative Otney and I did talk about this a month ago, and that we talked in an elevator. He didn't ask me for a meeting. He didn't ask to sit down with me. And I said, I'm always open to conversations. We had that meeting in the elevator. I accidentally sent out a note that describes every detail of what happens to the entire Minnesota House. That email has everything that you may need to look at. And if you have questions, you can sit down with me. But within that month, I have not had anybody request to sit down with me. I've had people ask me questions that I've responded via email. But I want to be very clear. I have done everything I possibly could. And I can safely say I've probably done more than 95% of legislators would have done on any bill that they have. And so with this, this is the way the bill is going to be. This is how it's going to move to the floor. And I appreciate the committee support of this bill.
I renew my motion that House File 1234, as amended, be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 1234, as amended, has been placed on the general register. Thank you, Representative, for all your work on this bill. Before we get to the next bill, which is House File 782, I'm going to go back on the agenda and ask Vice Chair Edelson for a motion for approval of the minutes from Friday, April 21st, 2023.
That's my motion.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. So now Representative Becker Finn moves that House File 782 be placed on the general register. So thank you, Representative Becker Finn, and you have a DE1 amendment. Would you like to describe that, which would essentially be describing your bill before we vote on that? So Representative Becker Finn moves the DE1 amendment.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. The DE1 reflects agreements and changes since this bill was first introduced. I've been working on this bill for 7 years now. The DE reflects an agreement and some compromise between myself and the Senate and other interested folks, and is the language that was vetted and discussed in the Pensions Commission and did pass with bipartisan support in the Pension Commission. I don't know if you want me to go into any further detail, but that's the DE.
Great. Thank you, Representative Becker Finn. Discussion to DE1. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the DE1 is adopted. So any further comments to your bill as amended, Representative Becker Finn?
Yep, thank you, Chair Olson. So this is the Secure Choice Retirement Program. What it does is it establishes a new retirement savings plan for employees, for workers who don't currently have access to payroll deduction to contribute to their retirement savings. What we know is around half of Minnesota workers are not currently saving for retirement, and obviously that is a problem. If folks are going to retire, they do need to start saving, and the sooner they do that, the better. So this plan, it would be run through the State Board of Investment. We would be setting up a Secure Choice Board to outline some things as far as if you're already providing this to your employees, you don't have to change anything, but it would allow this, require this as an option for employers who are not currently offering plans. It is supported by the AARP, the Minneapolis Regional Chamber, Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, Council on Latino Affairs, and I think importantly, the American Retirement Association, which is actually folks who make money off of selling plans and work in the industry, and they are acknowledging that there is a gap and we do need to do something, and despite their best efforts, plans like this are needed to make sure everybody is able to save easily for retirement. That is the bill, and happy to take questions.
Thank you, Representative Beckerson. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just really quickly, since this is the Finance Committee, can you let us know the cost, both in the biennium and the tails?
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Beckerson.
So it would be 1.3 in 25, and then 2.846 ongoing. I figured we would ask that because this is the Ways Committee. Just to outline, so there would be a couple of FTEs within the State Board of Investment, some expenses within the Attorney General's office, and then setting up the board itself. There are some FTEs there. Other costs to Department of Administration and the Pension Commission would be absorbed. So a little bit of setup fees, and then, you know, some fees to keep the plan rolling and do the administrative stuff.
We're just talking about the bill overview and the fiscal note and making sure it's correct to the DE1. So just pause for a second.
That's what I was hoping. We did change stuff. So.
Yeah. Fair question.
They knew I was going to ask that. Thanks for the coffee, by the way.
So we're actually going to go to Ms. Adrian's just to explain a little bit with the new DE1 we adopted and how that compares to the fiscal note. If that's you were correct in describing, there's nothing. But I think we're going to just further add clarification given the DE being adopted.
No problem going to the professionals in the fiscal department, Madam Chair.
So, Ms. Adrian's.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Beckerfin did a great job of explaining it. So I don't think I have too much to add. The original version of the bill had blank amounts in the appropriation or for the transfer, actually. So there was a fiscal note done. It is not up to date to the DE, but there is a one-time $5 million transfer. And then the costs that are required for the startup that Representative Beckerfin outlined will be paid for out of that established account for this program.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for clarification, so transferred what from the general fund? Is it going to a special revenue account? Can you just tell us the accounts, please?
Ms. Adrian.
Of course. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative O'Neill. So on the DE amendment on the last page, on line 18, it's a transfer, and it is exactly what you just mentioned. It's a transfer from the general fund to the Secure Choice Administrative Fund for these purposes.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if it's a transfer of $5 million, is that in this fiscal then? So instead of $1.3 million, it would be $6.3
million? Ms. Adrian.
Madam Chair and Representative O'Neill, so because it's a transfer into a separate account out of the general fund, the money won't cancel back. So the $5 million will be available for the estimated costs for each of the years that are outlined in the fiscal note.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Anything further, Representative Griffin, on that?
I think Ms. Adrian's did a great job. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Yeah, just really quickly. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the fiscal note that we have in front of us, Ms. Adrian's, I'm just wondering, I realize that the $5 million from the general fund goes into a special revenue account, but it's still a cost to the general fund, which is... you know, that's what we have on page one, the general fund cost. I guess you have the special revenue account there too, which has zeros in it. So then it just is still $1.3 million then, not because it's just going in and sitting there. But it'll be cost in the tails then because it has to be expended.
Ms.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative O'Neill. So the amount that is available for this bill is the $5 million. And so if the cost in the first biennium is $1.3 million, that will be debited against that original $5 million. And then there will be, about 3.7 if my math is good. And then the cost available for the next biennium, it should cover that as well. And then if in the future there are ongoing costs, I believe it would need to be revisited and more money would need to be transferred into this fund.
Representative O'Neill.
Okay, got it now. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry to speak twice today, but I just wanted to thank Representative Jamie Becker-Finn for this
It's a weird bill to get super excited about, but I'm really excited about what this does for folks, especially our young folks that might be working an hourly job and just aren't thinking about it. But if their employer mentions it, they're like, you know, I could do $5 a paycheck. And then when they leave that job, they might not do it anymore, but then it sits there and it accrues interest. And this is something I've heard my husband talk to our kiddos about countless numbers of times, and they're lucky because their dad did talk to them about this. I'm thinking of a job our daughter did in a gap year before medical school, and it didn't pay well, and she was living at home, so she took half of it and stuck it in a retirement account. And it's just sitting there for later. And this is just a huge thing for folks to have the ability to do this, and I just want to thank you for the bill.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. When I was elected, Governor Pawlenty was the governor, so served 2 years under him. And he had a philosophy that said, if it's in the yellow pages, and I know some of the millennials and younger people in this room don't know what yellow pages are, but he said, if it's in the yellow pages, government shouldn't be doing it. And I just want people to know out there that there are private sector solutions to do exactly this. Representative Joachim just alluded to that, that her daughter put things in a private account. And I think this is wrongheaded that we're mandating businesses to do this. If they want to and they elect to, that's fine, but we shouldn't be mandating. That's my only comment. Thank you.
Further discussion, we'll go to Lead Garofalo to close before final words from the bill author. Lead Garofalo.
Thank you. Madam Chair, neither a question for the author, you, or for Ms. Adrian's. This appropriation, which budget target is it carried in?
Representative Becker-Finn, we'll start there, and then we'll go to Ms. Adrian's. Yeah, Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Chair Olson. It's out of the pensions target.
And I believe this was originally included in the pension omnibus bill that we heard last week, but got taken out so that it could have further work to do on its own. So it still counts in that target, though. Representative Bravo.
Thank you. Madam Chair, and same question either for Ms. Adrians or for the author. Is there any tracking of what this will cost employers in terms of time or paperwork or unfunded mandates? I didn't see any notes for that in the fiscal note. Is there any tracking for what this is going to cost the employers who are involved in this?
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And there isn't, because the costs are really minimal. And we know there's other states who have been doing this with success, particularly Oregon was one of the first states to start doing it. Essentially, it's just the time that it would take you when you're onboarding someone to get them enrolled in the program. We also have the rollout will not be everybody all at once. It's sort of dictated that it happens incrementally over a two-year period. I can tell you so when I was first asked to carry this bill, I was not a small business owner, but I am now, and am now very familiar with all of the programs and things you do when you set up a new employee. So this would just be, you know, the additional time that it would take when you're hiring on that new person to get things set up.
Anything further? Nothing further. Final word to your bill, Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a couple things I just wanted to point to in particular, and the handout from the AARP, what we know from studies is that for workers earning between $30,000 and $50,000 a year, about 72% participated when they had an employer-provided retirement program. When they did not, fewer than 5% of people participated in programs. And I think further, as I noted, you know, it is quite notable. It's a very, I guess, nerdy group to brag about getting support from, but the American Retirement Association is a big deal. You know, the ARA recognizes that despite our best efforts in the private sector, there are far too many Americans without access to a retirement plan at work. So that is what we are trying to fix in this bill, and would appreciate everyone's support.
Thank you, Representative Becker-Finn. And with that, Representative Becker-Finn renews their motion that House File 782, as amended, be placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails, and House File 782, as amended, has been placed on the General Register. Thank you. And our next bill today is Senate File 2744, Representative Stephen, the Commerce Budget Bill. So welcome to the committee here, and we're going to do a couple of things to get the bill in the shape you need it to be. So I will move that 7 at miles 2744 be placed on the general register. And then you have the DE4 amendment, which is inserting the House language onto the Senate bill. So would you like to adopt that amendment, go through the amendments first? Would you like us to get it into the shape you want and then present the bill? Because the DE is your bill, correct?
That's fine, Madam Chair.
Okay. So the DE, and so we'll have discussion on the, I'll move the DE4 amendment. And do we want, would you prefer, you would, Representative Garofalo?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Stevenson. For lack of a better word, this is the conference report, right?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, that's aspirational at this point. I think that you kind of, when I introduced the bill, what I was going to say is that the DE moves us closer to where the into alignment with the Senate. It reflects a number of agreements, which I can go through when I walk through the bill. I don't know that we're all the way there just yet, but I'm sure hoping we're close.
So, Madam Chair, and thank you. And Madam Chair, something, you know, we try to keep the committee focused on finance, but sometimes policy makes its way into the amendments we offer. There are substantial policy interactions in this bill. I know that you have stated that your intent that you're not going to be taking public testimony today. I thought that when we involve policy in this committee, especially new policy that is either substantial changes or we have not seen in other committees in the House, that we would want to be flexible in that arena. It's your prerogative, I understand that, but particularly with the I assume, Representative Stevenson, you've seen some of the letters that are in the packet today.
Representative Stevenson, and maybe do you want, maybe it will be best if you just walk through the DE4 now then, and then it sounds like we're kind of starting to discuss that, and then we can bring up the point. I think you want to talk about a specific part with those, or
correct.
Is that, yeah. Yep. So why don't we do that? So why don't you go ahead and describe the DE4 amendment, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to, before I walk through, I do want to just quickly say that the policy in the bill, 95%+ of it was in the Commerce bill as it left the Commerce Committee, including the provisions that you have received letters about today. So right to repair, age-appropriate design, those provisions were in the Commerce bill as it left the Commerce Committee. There's a change to the right to repair language in the next amendment that you will consider. But this is not new policy. It was in the Commerce Committee, received a hearing, and the Commerce Committee was in the Commerce Omnibus that also received a hearing. So this is the Commerce Omnibus Bill. It is sort of generational consumer protection work, in particular focus on big pharma and big tech protecting Minnesotans from the abuses of those very large industries. We received a $10 million target in the biennium and a target of a savings to the general fund of $265 million in the tails. That's due to an operation of a transfer from the premium security account back to the general fund that you can see, I believe, on line 202 of the spreadsheet. And I want to be clear about the reinsurance implications because members often have questions about this. This is not changing the status quo on reinsurance. We passed a reinsurance reauthorization bill last year that reauthorized the program for 5 years, but only funded it for three. That was the compromise agreement between the House, the Senate, and the governor last year. Due to a change in federal law some savings in the program, we actually appropriated more money than necessary to fund the program for 3 years, and so we are transferring the excess back to the general fund. We're not changing how many years of reinsurance operate that are operational under that agreement. There's just a couple of changes kind of in the spirit, in the spreadsheet, in the spirit of what we're just talking about as we try to get closer to the Senate position to either obviate the need for a conference committee or narrow the focus of it considerably to just a couple of items. But the changes on line 65, there's a report on blends of gasoline and biofuels. That's a $24,000 appropriation both in the biennium and in the tails. And then on line 137, there's dues payments for NCOIL, which has been carried in the Commerce budget for many years. other than that, the spreadsheet remains the same as it was when it left the Commerce Committee. There are a few changes, as we kind of just alluded to, in the policy language. I can skim those. There's some modifications to the Family Protection Act. This relates to family exclusions in boat insurance. The compromise position that's in this bill is that the default position would be to not allow family exclusions, but insurers would be able to get an endorsement that would allow for family exclusion on their policy. There's also new language. There was always language in the bill codifying the ACA's no cost sharing on preventative services. That language was slightly modified. There was a court decision out of Texas that struck the federal ACA's provision as to preventative services, and we changed the language to better respond to that. It's very important that we preserve Minnesotans' access to preventative care, including cancer screenings and PrEP and PEP, and the language is explicit in that regard after reviewing the federal court decision out of Texas. There's a compromise language with regard to health benefit mandate reviews after discussions with the Senate, the governor's office, and stakeholders. The language tries to achieve the same goal as the language that left the Commerce Committee, but is in a slightly different form. Now, there is a new piece of policy increasing remedies for robocall violations. This was Senate language that actually was not introduced in the House. Otherwise, I probably would have heard it and included it. there's language relating to price gouging by contractors, storm chaser contractors, in the advent of extreme weather events. That is also compromise language. So that is maybe a summary of what's in the DE that's different from what left the Commerce Committee in terms of policy.
Okay, so to the DE4 amendment, we do have one more author's amendment to the DE4. Perhaps we take that up and do that, and then we can discuss the DE4 as amendment. So I will move the A2 amendment, and if you could please discuss the A2 amendment, Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the A2 amendment reflects some of the discussions between stakeholders, House and Senate, the House and Senate authors on the right to repair language, and trying to get at concerns that stakeholders have about protecting cybersecurity. It's my understanding that while this moves a step towards compromise, that there is still some dissatisfaction with the language, which is why you're getting a bunch of letters.
Discussion to the A2 amendment. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Stevenson. So I want to call your attention on your A2 amendment to line 1.14 and 1.15. If I could just be blunt, who wrote that those two lines? As somebody who does this in his private sector job, I found those two lines fascinating. Could you cover the intent of that and maybe where that language came from?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, it's my understanding that the House and Senate authors of the Right to Repair legislation had a discussion with stakeholders earlier this week and then worked in with House Research to draft language to try and address some of the concerns that those stakeholders raised.
Representative Garofalo.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, is Representative Fisher here? Or?
I don't believe he is.
Okay.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, I'm just going to go on a limb here as somebody who, again, works in technology. There's no way the stakeholders had any involvement supporting that language. None. And I say this from a technical perspective, that I don't know, let's read the lines to people. It says, and this is the right to repair language. This is about what needs to be turned over and where. It says, nothing in this section requires an original equipment manufacturer to share parts, documentation, or tools related to the manufacturer's cybersecurity. That's not adult language in this sector. That's not what that is. And it's not a criticism of our nonpartisan staff. It is a criticism, I think. I believe the authors were intending to solve a problem. They did not. I can assure you of that. But Representative Stevenson, and again, this is a provision carried by someone else that's in your omnibus bill. Have you had a chance to review the letter from IBM dated yesterday? It was in our packet.
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I did have a chance to read the letter, yes.
Would you?
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, can you just offer some commentary on what they're saying there? Is it something you agree with their concerns on, something you disagree on? Can you just... You've had an opportunity to read it. Any thoughts on this?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, you know, I think that there's an agreement, as you can see in this amendment, that there's a legitimate concern about the impact on security by this legislation that the authors are trying to achieve. The solution that I understand IBM and others are proposing, that we just wholesale exempt business-to-business and business-to-government transactions, strikes me as not in scale to the problem that's trying to be solved. You don't have to throw out every single business-to-business transaction in order to get at concerns about security. And I think that that's what Representative Fisher and Senator Kupek are trying to get at with this, that this language is a more tailored approach to the concerns that are being raised.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Stevenson, while this is the amendment to your delete all amendment, I would like to reference the delete all amendment for the underlying bill on page 167. And Representative Stevenson, if this is something that others have signed off on, I don't want to be asking questions of you and asking you to defend things that, while you're the author of the bill, it's not the first time that you members would be carrying legislation for other members. I get that. But on page 167 lists exceptions to the right to repair bill. Can you offer some commentary on your thoughts on those exclusions that are included in the bill?
Representative Stevenson, and I totally understand, and we'll do this because there is stuff in here that we're vetting as we have moved this amendment forward, and I think we'll have whatever discussion we need, but at some point we'll turn it back towards fiscal too. So, Representative Stevenson.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I will note that the Subdivision 6 exclusions is unchanged from the DE amendment, from the language that was heard in the Commerce Committee, both on an individual basis as well as when the omnibus bill came before the committee with right to repair included. And I certainly would encourage you to speak to Representative Fisher about that language to get more detail into how it was constructed. I think that there is an understanding that this concept of right to repair works in certain settings and doesn't work necessarily in others, and I think that excluding some of those other settings is what this language is getting at. But if you want more detail about how that language was constructed, I think you'll have to talk to Representative Fisher.
Representative Garofalo.
And thank you. And Madam Chair, and again, I understand that we try to stay on finance, but this does have policy in it. And the reason why I think it's relevant to talk about on page 167 these exclusions is as this bill was moving forward through the process, there was certainly communicated an expectation that stakeholders would have an opportunity to work on it and address it. It also, but what appears to be happening is this is likely to be the conference report, that there's not going to be a conference committee on this, that what is sent over is going to be concurred on. So people in the audience, people who are watching from home, they feel like the switcheroo wasn't done on them, but they certainly thought they had more time, had an opportunity to address some of these things. So that's why I'm bringing those up, Madam Chair. And I would just, and it's not, I mean, I look at these exclusions, and it's fascinating to understand why business-to-business transfers are not, we can't have that exclusion in there, but we have energy storage systems in the bill. Nothing in this section applies to an energy storage system as defined under Section 216B2422. It's fascinating that we have the diagnosis and maintenance or repair of video game consoles and its components and peripherals. When you look through the exclusions that are listed, Madam Chair, in 167, there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason to what is excluded and what is not allowed to be excluded. The only consistent thing seems to be that someone asked for it. And these are, and again, you have members in our packets. We have a letter dated today from a litany of organizations on there. I certainly understand that the House author of the right to repair and the Senate author, I'm sure these are very smart, wise individuals who have a lot of knowledge about a lot of things, but they do not know everything about everything. And that is clearly reflected in the language on page 167 as well as the changes to this. So this is a significant disruption to market activities. And Madam Chair, I know you mentioned earlier that you don't want to take testimony. I do think the IBM letter specifically is incredibly relevant, especially given that it's referenced in the not only in the delete all but in the amendment to the amendment. If there is
if we could, I think in our rules we're supposed to allow public testimony, but if we could hear from somebody from IBM, I would like to hear some additional context about this, and I think it may be important for members of the committee and the author of the underlying bill to hear about this, if that's a possibility.
Representative Raffel, I had said at the outset of the committee for other bills too, we didn't hear testimony. We typically don't. We had communication from folks from IBM wanting to testify. We already had mentioned we would not be taking public testimony. But to your point, I think that there is a letter here and all members did receive it in their packets. And it sounds like I know Representative Stevenson has read it and had a chance to have conversations about it. I've read it and reviewed it. I hope everyone here has, and that conversations will continue. But to your point, it is in my prerogative to continue the committee rule we do have for this year that is in our committee rules in our packets. So I will just note again, like I did on the other bill where we had a substantial amount of written testimony come in, and we did not allow testimony on that bill, and we won't on this one either. But Representative Groffel, to your point, it is in the packets. Representative Groffel.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, again, because this is likely to be the conference report, and because members of the public can't testify in the House floor or on the Senate floor, and we do have new policy language here, we are not allowing the public in any way, shape, or form to testify on that change anyway. And it's new language. It's not like it's certainly you can make an exception for when language is passed in the Senate, and you can say, well, they took public testimony in the Senate, or if it was language that was heard in the House. Certainly the video game council exclusion was included in that. This is new policy language, and we're saying in terms of how that statement may or may not be in conflict with House rules, I would just urge you to reconsider that. But Representative Stevenson, I think you know my concerns. I think you understand the concerns of a significant number of stakeholders who normally do not get involved in the legislative process. It's damaging. And I know so I will just leave it at that. Representative Stevenson, I would hope that after you adopt these amendments, that perhaps the pause button is hit, and maybe that there's some change that can be made to this, because this is not the sort of thing that we want to clean up later. So thank you.
Further discussion to the A2 amendment. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Garofalo stole my criticism of the fact that this is not lines 1.14 and 1.15, that's not what anybody in this industry that I work in, that he works in, would ever write. And Representative Neward, this is not written by a practitioner. This is not written by someone who has to go and fix things or even bring it to reality. This is not written by somebody who is a serious cybersecurity technical person. You know, Representative Garofalo does networking, I'm in cybersecurity. Both of us can tell you within 100% of surety, this was not written by somebody who actually is a serious practitioner, nor do they do this for a living. So to that end, you know, when the right to repair became kind of a fledgling idea, I think we all, if you ever watched the Andy Griffith Show, you think of Emmett Clark, the guy that has a repair shop. Everybody wants to have somebody who can fix their toaster or fix their blender or fix something that when you open it up, it's fairly self-evident as to what's going on under the hood. But when you open up some of the tech that is listed by the list of opponents, well, if you can figure it out on your own, well, I'll be shocked. But what it exposes, if you don't have the training and the certifications that go along with these things, is a lot of liability. And you know, you could, to make it easier, you could effectively open up some of the things that these manufacturers make, IBM or some of these other. You may as well just open it up, disassemble it, put it in a bag, shake it up, and hope that it comes back in working form. Because you won't get it back. And it opens up a lot of the proprietary information that they build into much of what they build into. So let's reduce it down to possibly something as simple as your phone that we carry around. I will guarantee you that a lot of proprietary information will be exposed to bad actors and will make it easier to defeat things later on if you simply just allow someone to blithely open up stuff and demand of the manufacturer that they give you the tools to do so. This is not a toaster. This is not, you know, a fan that you have running in the corner of your house. This is really complicated stuff. You know, Representative Garofalo was talking to me about something that he was doing over the last weekend, and I've been in this industry for a long time, and he had to walk me through some of the stuff that he was doing, and that was just to get it to a high level, because I don't do networking.
Don't tell him the whole story.
I won't tell him the whole story. but members, this is, I get, and I know that some manufacturers have made some deals. Like, I know John Deere made a deal on certain things along the way, and I appreciate that. But there is a lot more to this. And Representative Stevenson, I don't blame you for not knowing this. I've seen this before. Someone comes and says, hey, I need this in your bill. It's really good language. Trust me. Don't trust this. This is problematic. You know, having worked for many, many years in the storage industry, I can tell you that if you were to go and try to open up anything that sits in a data center and just kind of poke your head in and say, I'm going to fiddle with some stuff. I have a roadmap that they gave me. It's going to go badly. Don't do this. This is a bad idea. This is not a toaster.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Stevenson, I've worked with you on some other bills and so forth, and you've always been very amenable to listening and making changes. And you seem like a fair person. And I'm just wondering if I made a motion to send this back to your committee, would you have a hearing on it so that this stuff can be aired in the public?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, well, I appreciate the kind words. We had two hearings on the right to repair in the Commerce Committee, one on the standalone bill and one as it was included in the Commerce Committee. We haven't had a hearing exactly on this provision in the A2 amendment, nor would I want the bill to go back to the Commerce Committee to have a hearing on one line in an amendment. We wouldn't do this if this was a floor amendment, which obviously bills get amended on the floor with language that was never heard in committee every day at this place. So, no, is the answer.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm really sorry to hear that. In reading this letter from IBM, if you go to the last paragraph on the first page, it says, entrusting the diagnostic and repair of these systems that run the critical infrastructure on which our day-to-day lives depend. I mean, that's what's at stake here, is parts of our critical infrastructure being at risk if changes aren't made in the language in the A, was it the A2 or A4? I don't remember what the amendment was. And then, so does that give you concern at all, Representative Stevenson?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, as I mentioned, we had, you know, two hearings on exactly this language that applied to those industry in the House of Commerce Committee, both when the bill was heard standalone and when it was heard as an omnibus bill. I think that the solution that's proposed by IBM here to exempt all business-to-business transactions is way bigger than the specific problem of trying to get at some security issues. There might be a way other than what the language in the A2 is to address that, and I'm certainly open to having those discussions. My door is always open to stakeholders. I've met with IBM. I've met with other people, even though this is not my provision in the bill. I've taken those meetings and heard them out, and, you know, I think, as I mentioned at the outset, the goal is to get as close as possible so that we don't have to have a conference committee or have a fairly narrowly defined one, but there's still more time to have discussions.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Stevenson, what's wrong with having a conference committee on this commerce bill? It's going from less than 100 pages to over 200 in this amendment. So what's wrong with having a conference committee?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, we're just trying to be have conversations and work as expeditiously and efficiently as we can while making sure that we're hearing all voices. And like I said, we've had multiple hearings on this provision. My door has been open. Representative Fisher's door has been open. Senator Kupek's door has been open. We've had conversations. We will continue to have conversations. I understand that this is a provision that causes members some concern. It has always been a controversial provision. I've heard it in the Commerce Committee when I was chair last biennium. I heard it when I was on the committee but not chair the biennium before. This is a provision that is controversial, and no matter how many hearings we have on it, will remain controversial. And so we're having the discussion, but at some point there's a time for choosing.
Representative Scott. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the piece about critical infrastructure should concern us all. So if there's any way to reach some sort of compromise so that we're not putting critical infrastructure at risk, maybe that might be a really good thing to explore. So, and I know that you said you've had hearings on this, but this new amendment that Representatives Garofalo and Nash alluded to in the language, that's new. Also new is line 168, point 5 and 6, the applicability of this, and it says this section applies to equipment sold on or in use on or after July 1st, 2017. And that is also new in this DE amendment. And so I'm just wondering why that was added, Representative Stevenson, if you know.
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I believe that actually narrows the applicability of the underlying bill.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. I'm just wondering, Representative Stevenson, how that number, the date of July 1st, 2017, how was that arrived at?
Representative Stevenson.
Representative Scott, Madam Chair, I think that in order to get really into the weeds on this, I would encourage you to talk to Senator Kupek and Representative Fisher, because it's ultimately, you know, their bill that they've been having those discussions with stakeholders, but I understand it's a compromise.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's problematic. I mean, we've got letters again in our packet stating the reasons why that is problematic to go back, what was that, 5 years, 5-6 years? Equipment changes, and some of it may be even obsolete. I think this is going to be just really problematic going forward, and I would suggest, and I'll be glad to reach out to Representative Fisher, but I'd be glad to suggest that we go back no more than 2 years. That seems to be what the industry standard would be, without creating large hiccups in supply chains and other things. And I do have one more question for you, Representative Stevenson. So how will this bill work with companies that, such as Canon, the photography folks, camera folks, if you have a problem with your Canon camera or lens or any part, you send it right back to them. There's no middle person. So how would this bill affect someone that wants to get their camera repaired? That's a Canon product.
And we'll go to Representative Stevenson. I think I've heard him say a couple of times he's doing his best with a bill that, you know, is a part of the omnibus package. And to that point, I'll let Representative Stevenson do more on this, but also understanding he is not the actual bill author for this provision. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scott, my understanding of the right to repair language is that if you had a camera that you wanted to have repaired, you would have the option to either do it yourself or work with a third-party repair operation instead of the exclusive opportunity, your only choice under, as you represent, and I'm not familiar with Canon cameras, so I'm taking your representation at its word that your option is to send it back to them and have them fix it. That's the only thing you can do. If you didn't want to do that under this bill, you could try and fix it yourself, or you could take it to a third party, and Canon would be required to give you sell you the parts, or sell the third party the parts that they would need to do the repair. So you would have more options, I think, is the function of the bill.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. Representative Stevenson, are other states that are adopting this fair repair sort of the law bill, do they have a retroactivity going back to 2017, or how far do they go back?
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, well, you stumped me on that one. I honestly couldn't tell you. I know that New York has passed a law in the recent future, and Colorado has passed a law, but I couldn't tell you about the retroactivity.
Representative, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Stevenson, my understanding is of New York, it's purely prospective. And I don't know about Colorado, but I do know for a fact that New York is purely prospective. It doesn't go back to, you know, 5-6 years back. Which again will be problematic. Thank you for the line of questioning, Madam Chair. Representative Stevens.
You're welcome, Representative Scott. Seeing nobody else on the list for the A2 amendment, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails and the A2 amendment to the DE is adopted. So now the bill is, and then we're going to vote on the DE2 amendment as amended. DE4 as amended. Let me get my notes out here. So we are going to, I'm going to move the DE4 amendment as amended. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails and the amendment as amended is adopted. So now the bill is in its final shape. Further discussion on the bill. Lee Carroll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's Representative Stevenson. For those who have concerns with this this section of the bill, do they call you or do they call Representative Fisher?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I think belt and suspenders is always the approach. I encourage you to talk to both of us. My door is always open.
So, Representative Garofalo.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, in seriousness, there does seem to be concern among stakeholders about who the decider is. And they were expecting there to be a conference committee. Should they contact, are you the decider or is representative? And I understand
you are.
It's a partnership there. They need to know who they can go to with the language because right now they don't know.
Representative Garofalo, I think he answered just talking to both him as the larger bill author and the bill author whose provisions are on the bill is probably the best approach without, but Representative Stevenson, I think.
Well, you know, the only thing, Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I think that one thing I would encourage members to understand is there's a difference between being heard and getting what you want. And, you know, my door is always open. That doesn't mean you're always going to get the answer you want. And that doesn't mean that people aren't being listened to or heard or having access or that they weren't communicated. There's been public hearings on this. I've been very clear with stakeholders about the process for this. Everyone's, you know, had an opportunity. And I think sometimes when people don't get the answer they want, they get frustrated, and I can appreciate that. But I think that that's important to keep in mind.
Representative Grapple.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Stevenson, that's certainly reasonable. I think the confusion that we're hearing from the government relations community right now is that direction on how to proceed is there's different messages being communicated to them on who they should talk to if they want changes, like who was actually authorized to make the decision. That's the thing I was trying to clarify. We can talk offline about it. That's perfectly okay. There are many other provisions in your bill I have concerns with, but in the interest of time, I'm just going to say I'll vote no in your bill.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the author, you know, you and I and a good many others worked together to get the liquor omnibus bill across the finish line last biennium. And I know that it was a moving and an evolving thing up until the very last minute. Can we have your commitment that in the face of serious concerns that everybody would agree are serious concerns that you would be willing to amend certain things out of your bill regarding the digital right to repair? Because I think, again, just the amendment that was added, the fact that that is not serious language at all, and I'm not gonna pick on him, but I think Representative Neuer was shaking his head as well that's not written by an actual practitioner. Don't come to any of us so that because we don't want to jade that, but seek actual input from people who do this professionally. Would you be willing to give us your assurances that you would listen to people who actually do this for a living that have concerns about this? Because if you're going to do this, it's either going to be challenged in court or have severely negative ramifications, or as Representative Scott said, it's going to effectively give a roadmap to people who would like to compromise the devices or services or whatever that get contained in here. And I'll share this with you. When we talk about security issues as people who work in this industry or up here at the Capitol. We intentionally don't share the nitty-gritty details because it's a roadmap to compromise. And I think what you're hearing from a lot of these folks who are sharing concerns is, if you do this, our ability to provide the efficacy that we have guaranteed is going to go right out the window when you have to hand over the instruction manual and map on how to, quite honestly, take down the device or whatever you happen to be working with. So could we get your assurance that before this hits the floor, that you would work with people who are actual serious practitioners to possibly alleviate some really negative repercussions?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, it is my practice and policy on all of the bills that I touch to have an open door policy and meet with anybody and hear anybody out. I have not said no to any meetings with any stakeholders. I will not say no to any meeting with any stakeholders on this provision.
Representative Nash. Seeing no further discussion, final word on your bill, Representative Stevenson.
Well, Madam Chair, it might surprise the committee to know there are other provisions in the bill other than right to repair, and they happen to be really important provisions for Minnesotans regarding the affordability of the drugs that people need to live. I think that this bill has the chance to be revolutionary for Minnesotans on terms of drugs. It includes, for example, Representative Howard's excellent bill to make sure that no one has to pay more than they can afford for insulin and other life-saving medication. It includes a prescription drug affordability board. The House language, the language that we're adopting today, would make it the strongest board in the country. And that is really a significant thing. So I'm proud of this bill. I thank the committee for its time, and I ask for a yes vote.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson, and thank you for also taking things that, you know, a lot of policy discussion on one part, and I know you had a bigger bill, but I appreciate, I know that my colleagues wanted to talk about that and you being a good sport about that, so thank you. So the chair renews my motion that Senate file 2744 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails and Senate file 2744 as amended has been placed on the general register. Thank you, Representative Stevenson. So our next bill and final bill today is House File 2, the Representative Richardson, Paid Family and Medical Leave. And so as you make your way up to the table there, I will move that House File 2 be placed on the general register. And I will also move the A53 amendment. And as you get settled here, would you like to just briefly describe the A53 amendment, Representative Richardson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, the A53 amendment reduces the upfront appropriation to the paid family medical leave account from $1.7 billion to $668.3 million. It makes $128.5 million in appropriations to 11 state agencies. That mirrors the fiscal note. It also clarifies with some technical language on the small business premium reduction, and it establishes base funding of $3 million per year in fiscal year 26 and 27 to MMB to cover agency costs.
Discussion to the A53 amendment. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Richardson, can you explain the language on lines 1.2 and 1.3?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Garofalo, for the question. So this is actually clarifying language that goes to the small business premium reduction. It was an amendment that was adopted in taxes that allows employers with less than 30 employees to have a reduction in premiums based on the first $50,000 in wages. And so this is just some technical clarifying language related to that small employer reduction of premium payments.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, Representative Richardson, I guess I'm not familiar. What is it? What is the reduction?
So for small employers that have less than 30 employees, you would have the first $50,000 within premiums. They would not have to pay premiums based on the first $50,000 of wages. There would be a wage exclusion amount that would cap out at $480,000.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Richardson, any idea what that estimate? I have not had a chance to see that in the fiscal note. What the aggregate savings would be to employers for that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so on the amended fiscal notes, there is a reference to that. I believe it's on page 3 of the HF25A fiscal note, and that'd be about $44.2 million.
Representative Garofalo. Seeing no further discussion on the A53 amendment, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails and the A53 amendment is adopted. To your bill as amended, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2 as amended establishes a statewide family and medical leave benefit program that would provide a safety net for families who need to take time away from work to care for a new child, care for a sick family member, or to recover themselves. I just want to take an opportunity to lift up the incredible amount of work that continues to happen around this bill as we're engaging with groups representing employers, business owners, the insurance and construction industry, state agencies, city and county considerations, social services, and families. This bill is a reflection of many voices, and we're trying to work to make it better for employers, including those interested in offering a private plan, while also ensuring that there are strong protections for workers as well. Ultimately, at the heart of this bill is a recognition of our universal humanity and a recognition that at some point we, our loved ones, are going to need some time off to bond, to heal, to recover, or navigate providing care for a loved one. I'll talk really briefly about some of the appropriations within the bill, as this is a fiscal committee. As noted within the amendment, this bill would front load $668 million from the general fund. In addition to that, there is an estimated about $70 million in administrative costs each year that are anticipated. The first year for fiscal year 24 and 25, that is a little bit higher at $83.4 million to think about the IT build out that is related to that. And aside from DEED, the fiscal note projects costs to 11 other state agencies. MMB would be at $16.8 million each year, the Met Council at $9 million, and the University of Minnesota at $6.4 million. The vast majority of these costs would be attributed to being an employer. And I will pause right there for questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Richardson. Discussion to the bill. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Richardson, looks FTEs looks like there's 407 now. Mm-hmm. Tails in the FTE for D in the current fiscal note. Fiscal notes is almost 90. Can you explain all this and where the estimates for all these FTEs coming from in the program?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that is correct. For the DEED portion of this work, it's projected to be 407 FTEs by the time the program is fully up and running at the start of fiscal year 26. The majority of these FTEs, 84% of them, would be responsible for handling applications and payment of benefits and also the appeals. There's also a handful of employers, I think 13 to 14, related to the 11 other state agencies as well.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Richardson, do we know what the what's the percentage of cost for the administration of this whole plan?
Representative
Richardson. As it relates to DEED, about 7% of the premium collection would be allocated to administrative costs.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Last question. What is that in dollars then?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in terms of the way that this plays out, DEET is projecting with the cost modeling that they have done that about $1.014 billion annually would be collected as it relates to premiums. And so it would be approximately 7% of that modeled number.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author. You said that in year one, there's an $84 million appropriation for the build-out, if I got that number correctly when you were just saying that, for the IT build-out. So you knew that I was going to go to that. I've asked that a number of times. Can you tell us what is the software that's going to be procured, or is it being built? And can you assure us what's going on? Because for those that don't know, the Washington model, the software, it's known not to work particularly well, and it's caused many, many problems. So could you maybe tell us what the $84 million is going to do and what piece of software is going to be used?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Nash, for the question. So I can talk to the fact that DEET has been looking not only at Washington but at other states as well, and I think the plan around the IT build-out is to clone some of the ways that our current UI system is working. And I think if you would like a much deeper sort of intel into the various systems that they would be looking at, the Deputy Commissioner would be able to speak to that.
Representative Nash.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And unfortunately, we can't talk about that here in committee, but is it safe to say that with some of the things that you're looking at, and you said the word clone some things from different places, that this is effectively going to be a bespoke solution, and it's going to require a lot of different pieces and disparate parts to be put together in order to get the software system that you're looking for?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Nash, for the question. I think that it's fair to say that the department has spent a lot of time looking at the other 12 states that provide paid family and medical leave and have had an opportunity not only to look at some of the best practices that exist, but also to have some of the lessons learned integrated into those decisions as well.
Representative Nash.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and this will be the last. Well, so once again, When you say that they're going to take the best pieces of this and that and make it into something, it's not an existing piece of software, and it's going to require that somebody, whether it be Minute or an outside contractor or whomever, to effectively take a blank sheet of paper and use things from different states, but that code isn't going to be available to them to build this piece of software. They're going to have to code it from the ground up. Or am I mistaken on that? Because when you say that they're going to clone best things and put it into whatever the Minnesota solution is, nothing exists today to do that with. And I'm just trying to figure out what are they doing from these other, I think you said 12 states? What are they doing from the other 12 states? Where are they getting that language, or how are they going to do that? Because if you've been here long enough, you've seen that when we do bespoke software, Chair Hornstein can speak to this almost as well as anybody else, and Chair Liebling can as well with some of the Minsure's things that we have done. It doesn't always work really well. We want it to work well, but I'm just trying to figure out how is that happening. How do you plan on getting there?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Nash, for the question. So when we talk about cloning, much of the bill of House File number 2 is cloned after our existing unemployment insurance program. And I think that I would also just lift up that the department had to do some significant work when it came to changes to implement the pandemic unemployment insurance program. And as a part of that work, we were among the first in the nation to get our system stood up in order to be able to pay out benefits. And so recognizing that there are some pieces of this bill that relate to the way that we currently do work around our unemployment insurance, I think that's an important piece of the cloning as well.
Well, I guess nobody walked into committee today thinking it was going to be IT day in Ways and Means, but I don't have a lot of faith in that. So I would love to get more if it's possible. Would love to talk to somebody about how this is planning on working, because I don't have a high level of confidence in that. And the software is going to be the very backbone upon which everything works or doesn't. I think we could all agree on that, that if you collect things and you're trying to track benefits and all that, it's all going to be predicated on the software working correctly. And I don't have that faith. So lots more discussion to come on the floor, guaranteed. But I think this, in the bigger picture, the software should be everyone's, at least in the top five concerns of what's going on beyond the very heavy-handed and draconian collection of all this. But the software should concern you. Put all partisanship aside. Look at it objectively and realize that many of the big things that the state has tried in the past that hinge on the success of a piece of software, and it should cause you grave concern about moving forward. Thank you.
And we have four people on the list, and maybe we could still get done at 11. Should we try for it? And then if not, we'll go slightly longer, but we can't go any later than 11:15. So with that, Representative O'Neill.
Duly noted, Madam Chair. Thank you. Okay, let's just talk about bill path just for a minute. As I'm looking at the fiscal note, and it's the amended, it was a 72-page fiscal note, and it includes Minn State and University of Minnesota. And it's not small costs. It's millions of dollars to both of those institutions. Did this bill go through the Higher Ed Committee?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Neill, for the question. It did not go through the Higher Education Committee.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Richardson, when was the first fiscal note finished and made available? And I'll ask the second part of my question to speed it up. How many committees that are policy and finance committees did this bill go through that did not have the fiscal note in front of them? Because it is a 72-page fiscal note. It is very complicated, as you have said. It is honestly nothing like unemployment insurance, although in very high-level concept, I suppose it could be. But in the details of it, it is nothing like that. And I should know because I served on Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council for many years and carried their bills. Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The bill went through the Workforce Committee, it went through the Taxes Committee, and it went through the Commerce Committee with a fiscal note.
And I will note, too, maybe you already said this. I apologize if you did, but we actually did have the bill, or the bill was re-referred back to Workforce to have a chance to vet it in its Committee of Primary Jurisdiction with a fiscal note. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it did not have a fiscal note for Judiciary, Finance, Civil Law. It didn't have it for State Gov. It didn't have it for Children and Families, Finance, and Policy. I can't remember if you said it, the labor and industry policy and finance. In any case, there were many of these committees that it had a decent impact on without a fiscal note that it went through, and it did not even come to the Higher Ed Committee. And as I was reading through the 72-page fiscal note, it does have quite a bit of an impact to Higher Ed, so that is problematic. I think that it probably should have gone through Higher Ed. Now, just to the basics of the bill, can you tell us which employers and employees will be covered by this in the state of Minnesota?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the bill will apply to employees broadly across the state. There are some exceptions that are written into the bill as it relates to independent contractors, There are also some premium relief for small businesses with less than 30 employees. And as it relates to the protection while taking leave, there are also some exceptions to reinstatement for time-limited positions or discrete projects.
Representative O'Neill. Thank you, Madam Chair. So this bill applies to nonprofits, government entities, higher education institutions, business, including businesses that have as little as one employee. Is that correct?
Representative Richardson. Thank you, Madam Chair. So with the carve out for small employers as it relates to premiums, depending upon how much that one employee would earn, it would be determinative as to whether that employer would be required to contribute any premium.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's talk about benefits really quickly, because this is I just want to fully understand this. So you have three basic categories, and you can take 12 weeks per category, and you can stack them on top of each other. So you could do 12, 12, and 12, which is 36 weeks in some situations. And can you just quickly go through who is in, like, what would qualify for of those three categories?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to clarify as it relates to the stacking of 12 weeks and 12 weeks, it would be 24. And there would be leave for a worker's own serious health condition or to care for a family member's serious health condition. There's also leave related to pregnancy or bonding. And then also there are opportunities for those on active duty to take leave as well.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, as I read the fiscal note, that's not exactly what I see. I see that first, pregnancy and medical leave are lumped together. And maybe the fiscal note's incorrect. I don't know. And then it lumps together family care benefits, so taking care of a family member, and bonding. So you could do pregnancy and then bonding, I'm assuming. So family care, bonding, and safety leave, which I'm not quite sure what you mean by safety leave, but that's all lumped together. And then extraordinary circumstances where there is a high need, high emergency, that's another 12 weeks. So, I mean, it's a little different than what you said, what's in the fiscal note. Okay, so then the next question and last question for me, and I'm sure my colleagues have all kinds of them, is I found something very interesting on page 54 of the fiscal note. If you have the fiscal note in front of you, I'll give you a second to turn to page 54. And I would... I'll wait till you get to page 54 of the fiscal note. Okay. So the third paragraph down, last sentence, says benefit payment weeks do not need to be consecutive. Can you explain what that means?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you could potentially have someone who is taking consecutive leave, but you could potentially also have someone who's taking intermittent leave.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, then the paragraph right above where it says assumptions, if you want to look at that really quickly, it talks about separate accounts will be created for each employer to record premium payments into the account and benefits dispersed out of the account. Can you explain what that means?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as it relates to the administration of benefits, that goes to the appropriations to deed because they would have ultimate responsibility for the administration of the program. The employers would be required to report information into deed in a similar reporting form as they do for UI as well.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think that's exactly what it means because the paragraph goes on. It says, beginning in the state fiscal year of 2027, each employer's premium rate will be adjusted to the rate that maintains at least 1.45 times the amount disbursed from that employer's account in the previous year. So they're going to look at the previous year's disbursements. So if they have, I don't know, three or four or five employees, and one person is out 12 and then another 12 and then potentially another 12 on top of that, that's a lot of money. And when I was reading through the fiscal note, the there's a cap on the per week disbursement, which is not taxed, by the way. It could be at least, we'll just throw $1,000 a week. That's an easy number. That was a little bit more than that was sort of the average. But that could be thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars that will be coming out of that employer's account, as it says. So the payments, the premium into the payment, or excuse me, the premiums into the account and the benefits out of the account are going to be calculated. And in 2027, you have to have 1.45 times the amount that was disbursed from that employer's account from the that was dispersed from the previous year. So if you've got just a handful of employees paying in and you've got one employee taking out thousands, how does that work, Representative Richardson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the program is a it pulls the risk across the state. So it creates a larger pool of individuals, which in turn brings down the cost of the benefit program. And I just want to also lift up that if you are if you have less than 30 employees, and I'll give you this example, if you have 10 workers all making less than $50,000 a year, the employer would not be required to pay any premium in that regard. And so I think it's important as we talk about this as the impact that it will have on small employees that we lift up that carve-out.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the carve-out is just minuscule compared to the scenario I just described. And I don't see it, I don't see anywhere in this fiscal note it talks about pooling, which is what UI does, which is why I was shocked when you said this is like UI, which I was hoping that it would be UI, you know, you pay in the premiums. And I know in yours it's like 0.7% of the wages coming into this account. But then when I read this on page 54, I was really confused because this is not that. This is not how UI does it. So unless you can point to somewhere else in the bill itself or in the fiscal note that counters what it says on page 54, I don't think that that's accurate. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And we have Petersburg, Pinto, Scott, and Garofalo on the list in 15 minutes. And our other option to finish this, if not by 11:15, is to recess at some point tonight during the floor session and come back and finish. So, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. And I'll just talk about two items here. One is kind of continuing on what Representative O'Neill said. So if at the end of all that time it doesn't achieve the base level of there, because with UI, premiums are adjusted every year, and we are backfilling some dollars. Can you tell us how we're going to determine the new premiums and how that's going to be backfilled in order to keep this fund appropriate? Because I was here during Minture startup, and I could tell you the first year it was in a big hole, and because there are a lot more people using it than what we anticipated. And so I'm concerned about how the first few years as it's being set up, that it stood up, that it's going to have a big devastating liability for us. So How would that work?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the cost modeling related to this has been done through the Institute for the Women's Policy Research at the University of Minnesota, indeed also used the U.S. Department of Labor Worker Paid Leave Usage Simulator, which provides an open source simulation tool that's used by researchers, the federal and state and local policymakers to model out the cost. I would bring the members' attention to page 9 of the fiscal note. As it talks through not only the modeling approach, but it also provides that DEED has been doubly conservative when it did the modeling that related to this work. So thinking of that in terms of they took a conservative approach and then doubled it. And that reference is on page 10 of the fiscal note, below the chart under total benefit costs. The values in this model output are doubly conservative.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. Well, I hope the predictions are there. Thank you, Madam Chair. My last question is, in regards to the employees that will be able to benefit from this and that are going to have to pay some of the premiums for that, have you talked to any of them? Are they aware that when this gets initiated, it will result in an automatic a wage reduction for them?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Petersburg, for the question. Yes, we've talked with employers. We've talked with employees as well. And in terms of, again, from the small employer perspective, for micro businesses, there would be those employers who would not be paying any premiums at all. And in terms of the interest and the want for paid family medical leave, over 80% of Americans across party lines support access to paid family and medical leave, you know, because at the heart of this is being able to care for yourself and your loved ones.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. I'll leave it with that. We're going to have a lot of discussion on third reading when we get to the floor. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Great. And Representative Scott, and for the rest of the members, if you have multiple questions, maybe just lay them out so I can go to Representative Richardson once to kind of answer them. And then if you have comments and they just kind of condense that down, that would be appreciated. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Richardson, I want to bring your attention to page 10 of the fiscal note. And give us a second to get there. And down towards that bottom paragraph, the first sentence, it says, the values in this model output are doubly conservative. First, DEED used the value for the upper confidence interval for estimated beneficiaries and so forth. And I'm just wondering, what did the other confidence intervals created in this modeling show, and what was the probability of those scenarios occurring?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as it relates to the leave pieces, you can see within the chart, DEED did modeling around the various types of leave that are available, and they made estimates as it related to the number of beneficiaries that would be taking that leave, and they also estimated the cost of that leave. And with that first line, they talked about the model output being doubly conservative, so they went to more people taking leave than they estimated as part of that conservative model, and then they doubled it.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Richardson. So, but I'm not seeing on that chart anywhere where it shows the other scenarios the other probability scenarios. Is that somewhere in the fiscal note and I'm just not seeing it, or?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what the fiscal note shows are the doubly conservative numbers.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not really answering my question there. We'll go to a different question. In the fiscal note, what's the average number of paid weeks that a user is expected to take for all claims? If you have
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the way that the modeling was done by Deed, it is laid out in the chart above the or under the total benefits cost. Again, it details the type of leave and the estimated beneficiaries along with the estimated benefits. It does not break it down by the number of weeks, but I would also point to in the bill that there is a belt and suspenders approach that is being taken related to an actuarial study that would be required to be reported to the legislature by October of 2023.
Last question or comment.
Sure, thank you. Thank you. My final question, and then I'll, based on her answer, I'll want to comment just to close. Representative Richardson, how many meetings have you had in the past 2 years with representatives from the business community?
Representative Richardson.
Over the past 3 years that I have carried this bill, I have had a number of meetings with folks from the business community, from employers, small business owners, nonprofits, associations, and city and county folks as well.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just make these comments. It just seems like I know you took in judiciary, I think you took an itty-bitty amendment that I had, and then you have this amendment where I think it's the 30 employees or 20 employees or less that you've made an accommodation for that. But I don't see any other movement over the last few years from the original piece in this bill. And I heard everyone complimenting Representative Herr earlier about how much she's worked with the stakeholders and how she's tried to work to accommodate different interests. You know, she had 15 different stakeholder groups. And I just haven't seen that with this bill. And this bill is gonna, this is gonna change a lot of the business and employee-employer relations going forward in the state. It's gonna make it's a bill of large magnitude. We know that just simply by the price tag alone. And so I just don't see that same sort of collaborative collaborativeness, I guess, happening with this bill. And that concerns me because, again, of a bill with this magnitude, we want to get this right, right? And I think there are stakeholder groups, the business community, they're not opposed to the concept of what this bill what this bill is trying to accomplish. It's the way in which you're trying to accomplish it that is, onerous. I have read through letters here from the St. Paul Chamber of Commerce, the Rochester Chamber of Commerce. I mean, the list of concerns is great. And so I just feel like this hasn't been given the due diligence that maybe it deserves for something of this magnitude. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. Very briefly, Representative Richardson, I do see that collaboration. I'll say that right across the border in Canada, as you know, 12 months paid leave, businesses of all sizes, 12 months. And as somebody who's an advocate for young children, the thought that that a parent is going to be back, is not going to be with their baby after a mere 12 weeks, it just drives me crazy. But I know that the compromises you've made and the coalition has made to get us to the spot we've been at, that we are at over the last couple of years is really incredible. And so I'm so grateful to you for that work. This is a dignified part of employment. There was talk earlier about different kinds of businesses involved. In all cases, they all involve people, human beings. who have needs, and you've structured this program to be based on unemployment insurance program, which I think is really powerful. So thank you so much for your work. It is critical that we make this happen, and thank you.
And final close, Lead Garofalo, before we go to the bill author.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, Representative Richardson, what are the reserve requirements in the bill?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Reserve requirements, see if I can find that. I will have to find the exact reserve requirements for you, Representative Garofalo, but I would also add that with the front loading of funds of the $686 million, it is designed to shore up the account as well.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. And we do have a nonpartisan staff who would be able to answer that if you would like them to come down to the justifier table. So I think we have Ms. James somewhere here. We have Marvin. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record, and if I trust you heard the question, but if not, Representative Garofalo can repeat it.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Marta James from House Research. I am not aware of a direct reserve requirement in the language. There is a premium adjustment in the bill, which I think speaks to the 1.45 was talked about that relates to increasing the amount in the fund if needed. And I can pull up that section. So it's the premium, Justin, is my understanding.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the nonpartisan staff. So there, I agree with you. My understanding is there is no reserve requirement. And then of the initial appropriation of 600 and some 60 odd million, is there any requirement that that portion of it be initially dedicated to reserve versus how much is going to be spent building it out?
Ms. James.
Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, I'm not aware of that offhand, but fiscal staff might be able to speak to that more than I could.
I'm pretty sure maybe fiscal staff can interject if we're wrong in those statements, but I think that's correct.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. Madam Chair, and so thank you, nonpartisan staff, for sharing your thoughts on that, or for verifying that. Representative Richardson, the last time, the reason why you're seeing this side of the aisle and other members be skeptical, or members of the public skeptical, is that the last time the DFL passed a payroll tax increase with an assessment with MnSure, the bureaucracy ended up naming conference rooms after DFL legislators. So sometimes we get a little bit skeptical about how money is being spent, but just at a high level view, what we have in front of us is a one-size-fits-all, mandatory, government-run, centrally planned model. This side of the aisle thinks that a flexible opt-in that's privately run and competitive would be a better way of doing things. Why is the model you're proposing better than the one that I and others have suggested?
Representative Garofalo, do Representative Richardson, we'll come back to you. Do you have any more questions you have for the bill author?
Depends upon her answer, Madam.
Okay. Representative Richardson.
Thank you. In terms of the system that we have right now, it is an opt-in system. And with the opt-in system that we have right now, who is being left behind in terms of having access to paid family and medical leave include women, communities of color, and low-income folks as well. With the current opt-in system that we have, the reality is that the individuals who tend to have access to paid family family leave are those who could float a leave if they had to versus individuals who are most likely not to have access to it. So this is about widening the safety net so that more individuals who have the need to either care for themselves, recover, or care for a loved one would be able to do that. And I would just lift up that this isn't a one-size-fit-all approach. There are, exclusions that are in here for independent contractors, looking at small employers, looking at individuals that might have seasonal variation to the work that they're doing as well.
Representative Graffel, final close here would be great. Thank you.
This will be the final close. Thank you, Madam Chair. Right now, employee and employer relationships deal with many, many items, lots of flexibility and individuality in them. If I have to understand this right, that when a young woman gets pregnant and she's scheduling a maternity leave, she's now going to receive her benefits. She'll be interfacing directly with state government for that. That is a massive change from the how private sector employees are used to dealing with the benefits that they receive, whether working with their HR department, working with their insurance providers. People now, for under the program you're advocating, when they have problems with their benefits, they're going to come to government. And when they have problems with government, they're going to be coming to you for that. So I would encourage members to vote no on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So I will go back to Ruth for just like, or Representative Richardson for a super brief close before we go to a vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for the questions as well. I would just like to reiterate what Chair Pinto talked about, because behind these numbers are people who are in need of support and who are in need of care. And I know that this is a finance committee, and so that's where we spend most of our time. And I also think that it's just important to lift up the fact that there is a cost in not doing this work as well. Understanding that there are human costs as you look at the rates of maternal mortality and infant mortality, preterm birth, and low birth weight babies, also thinking about long-term care as well. And so just looking forward to more discussion on the floor. Thank you for the opportunity, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. And with that, I renew my motion that House File 2 as amended be placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails and House File 2 as amended has been placed on the General Register. And with that, we are adjourned.